That lines, an Iraqi military base hosting U.S. troops comes under multiple rocket attacks amid growing anti-American sentiment. Palestinians hold a celebration after prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash ends his months-long hunger strike following a deal with Israel. And North Korea fires a suspected ballistic missile. The neighboring South says it won't yet give up hope for dialogue. Hello and welcome, everybody. U.S. military bases in Iraq have been the target of multiple attacks in the past 48 hours. We've spoken to Chief of the Press TV Baghdad Bureau, Navi Behrouz. He has the latest about the type and number of these attacks. Let's take a listen.
Hello and good morning. I have to tell you that early this morning we witnessed an attack on the United States Victory Camp near Baghdad International Airport. This attack was done by four Katyusha rockets. Iraqi officials say that these rockets have been fired from Al-Jahad region near the Baghdad International Airport and targeted this airbase. Of course, you know that U.S. forces are stationed in this airbase. This is the second attack on this airbase. Yesterday, there was a similar attack on this airbase using several drones, and Iraq has announced that these drones have been targeted, have been brought shot down. Before that, there was an attack on Ain al-Assad airbase using several drones, and this was a third attack. We also had two other attacks against a U.S. caravan, one in Yusufiya region near Baghdad, and another in Samawa province in southern Iraq. So in the past 48 hours, we had five attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq.
A senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the perpetrators who assassinated Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani will not be safe. Commander of the IRGC Quds Force, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, says that Tehran will never forget the martyrdom of Soleimani and his comrades. Ghani noted that Iran knows those behind the murder of the top Iranian commander, including former U.S. President Donald Trump and his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and will retaliate in its own way. He said Tehran aspired for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region, but achieved more than that when Iraq expelled American forces in effect. The IRGC commander highlighted the soaring anti-Washington sentiments in Iraq and the growing calls for the expulsion of the 2,000 U.S. forces remaining there. Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted pundits and officials from across the world to discuss the dimensions of the U.S. assassination of Iranian military commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. He was targeted in 2020 in an American drone strike in Iraq, Yusuf Jamali reports.
Political experts and academics from 20 countries are here to discuss the character of a man who is known as the nemesis of the terrorists, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was assassinated in January 2020 in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump.
When we talk about Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we're talking about a military commander who tasked himself with helping humanity, no matter if they were Christian, Azeris, or Sunni Muslims. That's what made him a revered figure who is loved by the people in the region, and millions took part in his funeral to pay homage to him.
So Qasem Soleimani is a human without a border. He's not an Iranian. He is for everybody because he helped Iranians, Syrians, Palestine, and so on and so forth. So when we talk of a hero, Qasem Soleimani is a real hero.
Soleimani is well known for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also spearheaded major operations in Syria that resulted in liberating key areas from Daesh. Observers say, by assassinating General Soleimani, the U.S. tried to resurrect the terrorists. However, they call it a miscalculation that backfired in Washington, triggering the beginning of its exit from the region.
The previous administration of President Trump has explicitly announced their responsibility for this crime. President Trump, he said that, I ordered to kill General Soleimani. Now, this hegemonic attitude has to be stopped. They have to leave us. They are the direct reason, the Zionist American access, the direct reason for the destability and lack of security in the region and internationally. They have to be pushed out.
The Islamic Republic now calls General Soleimani a martyr and hails him as a national hero. It says it is working closely with Iraq to prosecute those behind Soleimani's assassination and will not stop until all perpetrators, including Donald Trump, face justice.
These people say the world owes General Soleimani a big thank you for his role in eradicating Daesh, since the terror group was trying to extend its activities throughout the world. They say the United States made a big mistake by assassinating General Soleimani, since it led everyone to a safe interpretation that Washington must be on the terrorist team. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal is underway in Vienna. The United States says the negotiations have shown modest progress. The U.S. State Department has expressed hope that the parties to the talks can build up on the progress made this week. However, the British Prime Minister is warning that time for salvaging the accord known as the JCPOA is running out. In a phone call with his Israeli counterpart, Boris Johnson said London wants full restoration of the deal, but also needs Iran to engage in good faith. Tehran rejects what it calls the West's fabricated deadlines. Iran says it's up to the other side to speed up progress of the talks. Our Vienna correspondent, Homa Lezgi, joined us earlier with the latest on the Iran P4 plus one talks in the Austrian capital.
The head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagheri Kadi, held separate meetings with the EU coordinator, Enrico Mora, with the three European signatories of the JCPOA, Britain, France, Germany, and also with the Chinese and Russian representatives. And Mikhail Olyanov, the Russian lead delegate, in a tweet said that he had, in his meeting with Mr. Bagheri, discussed the main unresolved issues, and that he'd also met with Enrico Mora on finding possible ways ahead. You just said there in your story the expression modest progress being made. Just before the three-day New Year break, the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, said that we're in a stage now in the talks where indeed things are moving forward and progress is being made. And he said that even those delegates who were skeptical previously about these talks getting anywhere now acknowledge that progress is indeed being made, although in his words they're shy to come and express this to the media, because the way that the Europeans, the Americans and the EU coordinator have been talking about the process of talks, they usually refrain from making any overly a remark that could be interpreted as overly optimistic, and they insist on this issue of time and urgency and say that this should happen within weeks rather than months.
Palestinians in the occupied West Bank celebrate a rare moment. Prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash ends his months-long hunger strike after reaching an agreement with Israel. A lawyer for Abu Hawash says Israel has agreed not to extend his detention beyond February the 26th. The Palestinian was arrested more than a year ago and has been held without charge or trial since then. He began his hunger strike over 140 days ago and was hospitalized in December when his health worsened. His release has sparked joy among Palestinians. His brother says this is a victory over the oppressive Israeli regime.
I can't describe how happy I am. Today we are happy for Hisham, who won over oppressive criminal Israel. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the prisoners, martyrs, all the Palestinians, even for those who are in diaspora.
The agreement to release Abu Hawash follows big rallies that were held in his support across the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Resistance movements have also been threatening Israel with revenge if he dies in jail. Abu Hawash is only one among hundreds of Palestinians who are being held in administrative detention. That rule allows Israel to keep the detainees for up to 60 days without charge, and then a court can extend that period indefinitely. Far-right extremists reportedly continue to spread and recruit members in the U.S. despite a crackdown following last year's attack on the Capitol building. A research conducted by the Atlantic Council says some extremist groups have reorganized with a focus on local politics. It warns of the rise of far-right influencers in small social media platforms and the danger of radicalization. Far-right groups account for most domestic terror attacks in the United States. Last year's attack on the Capitol building put these groups under closer scrutiny. U.S. police have made more than 700 arrests in connection with the January 2021 attack on the Congress building. Anti-war activist Richard Becker blames the Democrats over their lenient approach toward last year's attack on the Capitol building and believes that's what is encouraging the spread of far-right extremism in the U.S. Let's take a listen.
The Democrats in charge of Congress have gone so slow, and instead of cracking down on what was clearly a right-wing insurrection led by fascist elements last January 6th, there's been really minimal consequences for those who have carried out those attacks. There's a few people who are in jail. Most of the people who have been arrested are released, awaiting trial or plea bargaining. And Trump himself, who clearly was the one who orchestrated and led an insurrection designed to illegally make him the president for another term, hasn't really suffered anything. And so we have the typical approach of the Democrats, and that is one that's very soft on the opposition, while the opposition is gaining in momentum because of that.
Japan and South Korea say North Korea has fired an unidentified projectile, the first such test by Pyongyang in the new year. The Japanese Coast Guard was the first to report the launch, saying it could be a ballistic missile. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the projectile was fired from an inland location into the sea east of the Korean Peninsula. The details are so far sketchy. This is Pyongyang's first launch since it fired off a new submarine-launched ballistic missile last October. It's been only a day since North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to continue developing his nation's military to counter an unstable international situation. Meantime, South Korean President Moon Jae-in has been quick to react, saying he will not give up hope for dialogue with the northern neighbor. When we reached out to our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, she believes North Korea is in fact trying to engage the U.S. and make it back off on its uncompromising policy towards Pyongyang.
It is clear from today's missile test that it is going to continue the many weapons tests that we have been seeing since the second U.S.-North summit in Hanoi under the Trump administration fell apart. So this means that the U.S. is under even more pressure to engage with the North than it has been. They don't have many options other than engaging with the North and negotiating with the North on the North's terms. It has to be more flexible towards the North and stop its hardline policy of refusing to give any sanctions relief or security assurances to the North.
More than 500,000 people have signed a petition for former British Prime Minister Tony Blair to be stripped of knighthood, an appointment personally made by the country's monarch just last week. The petitioners say the former premier should be tried and jailed for his role in the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003. Saeed Furaza has this report from London.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. 2 decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purizab, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Currently, the U.S. is pursuing a nuclear weapons modernization program that was launched by the Obama-Biden administration that is expected to cost at least $1.7 trillion by 2046. This includes large spending increases on a controversial low-yield smaller nuclear warhead, the total replacement of the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Force, new B-21 strategic bombers, B-52 upgrades, more destructive nuclear warheads, as well as other programs. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by John Lettman, writer. This article is published under the heading, 1 year in, Biden's nuclear policies look a lot like Trump's. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. When Biden became president 1 year ago, he inherited international challenges, vowing to rejoin the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, better known as the Iran nuclear deal, from which Trump unilaterally withdrew in 2018, Biden said the U.S. was prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same. Asal Rad, a senior research fellow with National Iranian American Council, told Truthout that despite high hopes that Biden would reverse Trump's actions, which helped drive the U.S. and Iran close to all-out war in 2019 to 2020, in many ways, Biden administration has continued the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy. The continuation of sanctions, Roth says, has only hindered efforts to revive the deal. After whiplash diplomacy in which Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea, only to later fawn over beautiful letters he received from Kim Jong-un, Northeast Asia analysts were hopeful the Biden administration would lead to a less erratic, more substantive phase of nuclear diplomacy. Although Biden said he shares South Korean President Moon Jae-in's stated goal of complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, Christine Ahn, executive director of Women Cross DMZ, told Herthout, "Much of this is rhetoric, and the Biden administration has not changed what she called the failed policies of sanctions, military exercises, and the travel ban. The U.S. will continue these militaristic policies until North Korea makes progress on denuclearization, which won't happen as long as the U.S. continues its hostile policies," Ahn said. She gives Biden a grade of D because he hasn't done anything to improve relations with North Korea, including declaring an end to the Korean War, which will be pivotal to advance denuclearization. Arms Control Association Executive Director Daryl G. Kimball told Truthout that Biden's first year of nuclear policy has been a mix of good, including New START, and bad, including an enormous nuclear budget, and incomplete or mixed, including the issue of North Korea. Kimball said it's not a simple answer that can be boiled down to a letter grade. In July, the association published an issue brief, which details why Biden's 2022 nuclear budget is very unhelpful, what Kimball described as an excessive and extremely costly plan to upgrade all major aspects of the nuclear weapons arsenal. Exactly what the role and purpose of nuclear weapons is in Biden's national security strategy will be detailed in the forthcoming nuclear posture review expected in early 2022. Kimball said the jury is still out on whether the president will follow through on his pledge during the campaign and in his interim national security strategy to reduce the role of nuclear weapons and to restore U.S. leadership on nuclear arms control and disarmament. "I have my deep concerns about whether this nuclear posture review will do that." The one area where Kimball gives Biden an F is for his failure to speak about the importance of reducing growing nuclear competition and the need to pursue a world without nuclear weapons. Kimball said, "I think it's a failure of leadership in his first 12 months not to have delivered a major or even a minor policy speech on the subject. If Biden chooses to do so, he can change that when the review conference of the parties to the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons commences in New York on January 4th. One of the most notable nuclear developments of Biden's first year in office occurred just 2 days after he was sworn in as president. On January 22nd, the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, entered into force, making nuclear weapons illegal under international law. Adopted and ratified by at least 58 countries, the U.S. and other eight nuclear weapons possessing nations opposed the ban. As Arms Control Association's Kimball points out, the TPNW contributes to a common goal shared by nuclear-armed states and non-nuclear-armed states, which is the pursuit of a world without nuclear weapons. The TPNW also reinforces the taboo against the possession and use of nuclear weapons. Beatrice Finn, executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, notes that when Biden took office, he inherited a disarmament situation that was in tatters, but he says the TPNW created a brighter spot. Instead of embracing this, the Biden administration has increasingly and aggressively attacked the TPNW and relentlessly pressured allies to abandon the treaty. Biden's disarmament policy, Finn told Truthout, is a D-minus, not the leadership that can save Americans from nuclear disaster.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hezbollah Secretary General has accused Saudi Arabia of terrorism and exporting Daesh ideology and sending explosive-laden cars to Iraq to conduct suicide attacks. Now, this in response to Saudi King's speech in which he called on Lebanese government to, quote, stop the hegemony of terrorist Hezbollah over the Lebanese state, end of quote. Nasrallah, citing multiple cases and points, blamed Saudi Arabia as a source of tension in the region, giving rise to Takfiri terrorism and stirring the situation in Lebanon.
The Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has accused Saudi Arabia of spreading extremist ideologies in the region and destabilizing West Asia as a whole. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in an address marking the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Nasrallah hailed General Soleimani and Mohandas for their role in fighting terrorism and the U.S. occupation of the region. He said General Soleimani played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria, as well as boosting the morale of the resistance front in West Asia. Elsewhere in his speech, the Hezbollah chief responded to a recent accusation by Saudi King Salman on Lebanon and the resistance movement. He said Saudi Arabia is a real terrorist that is exporting the Daesh ideology to the region and beyond. Nasrallah also slammed the United States for creating and funding Daesh to cause bloodshed in Syria and Iraq with the support of Saudi Arabia. He underlined that the creation of the Takfiri group was aimed at undermining the region's peace and security.
And for Daesh, where did this school of thought come? What is the mentality come? It came from Saudi Arabia. It's there on TV, on also Prince Mohammed bin Salman himself, who spoke about this. He himself said America asked Saudi Arabia for tens of years, the last decades, to come on spreading the Wahhabi school of thought in the Islamic world. As a whole, he said this. He said this himself. And he also said that Saudi Arabia also succumbed to this demand of the U.S. This is the ideology of Daesh.
Nasrallah also blasted Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies for launching a deadly and devastating war on Yemen with the backing of the U.S. He underlined that Riyadh is simply executing the will of Washington against innocent Yemenis. Saudi Arabia began its military campaign against Yemen in 2015 with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. Hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed in Saudi-led bombardments since then. Hassan Nasrallah's comments came as relations between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon hit a new low in October. The kingdom recalled its ambassador from Beirut and banned all imports after a Lebanese minister questioned the Saudi war on Yemen. Human rights groups have already denounced Riyadh for its war and an all-out blockade on Yemen. The crisis caused in Yemen has even prompted the United Nations declared that country the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this episode. Well, the political commentator and peace activist, Brian Terrell from Alloy. Also joining us will be manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm in Ottawa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to see you, gentlemen. Welcome to the show. Now, let me start with Brian. You know that Saudi Arabia has been spending billions of dollars to spread Wahhabism, its extremist ideology, and in return has inspired groups such as Daesh, Al-Qaeda, and other extremists. What's the goal of Saudi Arabia in doing so?
Well, I think the taproot of all this violence is from the United States. And I speak as a pacifist who doesn't believe in a military solution to any problem, but as an American citizen, have to see that this is where it started. And I joined Prime Minister Makati saying to stop the hateful sectarian political rhetoric in the area. But it's coming from both sides and you cannot have dialogue without speaking some very, very hard truths. Mm-hmm. And the violence is from the United States. Back in February, in his first public foreign policy address, newly elected President Biden joined the condemnations of the Saudi war on Yemen and said it was a humanitarian disaster and it had to stop. And he pledged that there would be an end to U.S. support for that war. But then in November, just this November, and this is on top of hundreds of billions of dollars of U.S. aid, U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia over the last decade, a $650 million deal selling air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia. That's continuing to support and to feed this. It's also very embarrassing for me as an American citizen that in November a new bill called the Stop Iran Drones Act was introduced in Congress. Mm-hmm. And one of the backers, Congressman McCall from Texas, said the people of the Middle East cannot live in freedom, stability, or prosperity under assault by Iran's drones. And this is at the time when the New York Times and other media outlets are making public for the first time the devastation that U.S. drones mm-hmm. have been causing in the region, the instability, and the fact that there are Israeli drones flying over Lebanon, that there are Turkish drones that are being U.S. ally Turkey and the NATO ally is exporting drones and their technology all over the region. And it was just announced in recent months that a Turkish company is going to be working with two Saudi companies to produce the Skyguard drone. It was going to be produced in Saudi Arabia. So we can't cherry pick. I think if we're going to be condemning violence in the area and calling for dialogue and calling for an end to hateful rhetoric, it has to be something across the board. And we have to see where does this come from and how does this originate?
Right. Now, for us, Sadistan Nasrallah, has Islam the U.S. for creating and funding Daesh to cause bloodshed in Syria and Iraq with the support of Saudi Arabia? And he said that the creation of Takfiri Group was aimed at undermining the region's peace and security. So I'm asking you the reason why Saudi Arabia is trying to destabilize the region by spreading such extremist ideologies.
You know, it's in the interest of Saudi Arabia to stay in their seats and keep control of this holy land. If you look at the originals and the originates of this is the establishment has been brought in by the British. The British really wanted an extremist, deviant, aggressive Islam, inside this holy land, so it can disrupt the Middle East and also keep people further away from the real Islam, the Islam of love, the Islam of peace, the Islam of unity. And Saudi Arabia has been always exporting the Wahhabi state-sponsored sect that they are dealing with and that they follow themselves. And this is a very extremist ideology. It spread so much terrorism and hatred inside Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon itself, all over the Middle East. And Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is one of the greatest anti-terror leaders in the region. We've seen how he integrates inside Lebanon, how he worked so hard with his group Hezbollah, that is part of the democratic system in Lebanon that has MPs, and they liberated Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. And he also worked inside Syria to fight all this terrorism. So he's a man of credibility. The man knows what he's dealing with, and he really cares about the unity of Lebanon. You know, one of his main allies one of his main allies is actually a Christian, Michel Aoun, right? The political party. Right. Unfortunately, a lot of these political parties have been also bullied right now. I mean, Saudi Arabia claims that they are helping the people of Lebanon, but they're actually imposing an embargo on Lebanon right now. You know what I mean? The currency has fell down to the lowest level in its history. As a human rights organization, we help outside in different countries, and one of them is Lebanon. We do help out inside Lebanon. And when we speak to the people in Lebanon, none of them have ever said that they've received any assistance or any help from the Saudi regime at all. Saudi Arabia only pays its puppets and the people that serve their interests. And these people usually are against Hezbollah, against the sovereignty of Lebanon. They just want to serve Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia obviously is working for America and for the control of who put them into power, right? Mm-hmm. So this extremism is obviously exported by Saudi Arabia, and we've seen even in recent times the Saudi Arabian regime itself spoke out about this, saying that we are in cooperation with the CIA and different organizations that have found that in our textbooks that we teach our students in schools that there's so much extremism and so much hatred. And they said that they want to change all this, and they're trying to, adjust everything and revise everything to be more peaceful. So they've already, themselves recognized that they have extremism in all their books, and they've been breeding this extremism, all over the Middle East, because, don't forget, like, it's the holiest place for Muslims, right? Everybody prays towards Mecca. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to go to a pilgrimage one time in their life to Mecca, towards Mecca. So they have a big influence on the whole Middle East and on the Islamic world. So, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is very on point with what he's saying, and it's time for people to speak out against Saudi Arabia's bullying strategy. You know what I mean? We can't just stay quiet, like what happened to George Kardahi when he spoke out saying that he's against the war in Yemen, and then they pulled their diplomats and caused this big animosity towards the Lebanese government and people. And it's time to put a stop to this and speak out.
Okay. Now, Brian, Hezbollah Secretary General also criticized Riyadh for standing behind armed groups wreaking havoc in Syria and Lebanon. Groups like Daesh or ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra, and Ahrar al-Sham. Tell us about the Saudi destabilizing role in Syria and Lebanon and beyond.
Well, again, as it's been pointed out, Daesh, ISIS did not exist, and the you know, the Taliban did not exist before U.S. intervention in the area. And it is so predictable that it's not, you can't really call it a unintended consequence, because this is what the natural, you know, the only course that could have been taken after what the U.S. was doing in the region. I think that if and some of the executives of Raytheon and these other arms manufacturers, you know, actually speak about peace breaking out in the Middle East as being an existential threat. They don't want it. If Syria and if Lebanon and if the people of Iraq and the people of Afghanistan, people of Palestine, were able to have the kind of governments that would serve the needs of its people and be trying to make peace with its neighbors, it would be devastating to the United States economy and the U.S. control of the region. So these ideologies are being fed and they're being stoked, and these conflicts are being exacerbated. The idea that if Afghanistan, for example, if peace would break out in Afghanistan, which would now over the horizon, the Biden administration is trying to prevent happening, it would be making peace with Iran, be making peace with China, be making peace with all of its neighbors, and a peaceful Middle East would be one that the resources of that region would be used to serve the needs of their own people and not the corporate interests of the United States. So yeah, this will continue to be fed, and the United States is very much dedicated to peace not breaking out.
Firas Nasrallah also accuses the Saudi king of terrorism and addressed him by saying, and I'm quoting him, that a terrorist is whoever takes hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of Lebanese as hostage and threatens the Lebanese state with evicting them. Let's have your take on that.
Yes, I mean, they've been doing this all over the Gulf region, right? Like holding them hostage, you know, taking away their passports. You know, in recent times I've spoke to several people that, you know, spoke to me about human rights cases where their family members are in the UAE or in Saudi Arabia, and, you know, they come and they try to interrogate them for being supportive of Hezbollah, looking at their phones, trying to see if they're affiliated with family members in different countries, such as, like, they have brothers, for instance, part of the resistance or so on. So they're all, you know, they use these tactics, these kind of bullying tactics. And this is what Saudi Arabia is. Saudi Arabia right now has actually, internally inside Saudi Arabia, they have worked now towards westernizing now, you know, parties and all types of corruption, things that are against Islam fully. They're doing that in Riyadh right now, big concerts and all kinds of things, right? So they're only concentrating on exporting the terrorism and the extremist ideology outside. As we can see in Yemen, there was no Daesh there, there was no ISIS until Saudi Arabia intervened. In Afghanistan, where did Bin Laden? Bin Laden originates from Saudi Arabia, right? He took this ideology from where? He took it from Saudi Arabia and he exported it out to Afghanistan and disrupted Afghanistan and destroyed Afghanistan. And then America came in with a justification and some type of fabrication to invade that country. And we see this, you know, everywhere. Like in Iraq, suicide bombers, even at that time, the Prime Minister Abadi, the former Prime Minister, said that we spoke to the Saudi intelligence and they told us there was 5,000 recognized suicide bombers that blew themselves up in Iraq. He said that the intelligence in Saudi Arabia told him this, that they have on file 5,000 suicide bombers. How many people did these people kill inside of Iraq? Innocent children and women and seniors. I mean, this is Saudi Arabia. This is the nature of Saudi Arabia's system from many years. You know, they cannot in any way disregard this. And the ministers in Lebanon should speak out. They should support Hezbollah. They should protect Hezbollah instead of condemning or criticizing Hezbollah for causing some kind of problem between Saudi Arabia and Hezbollah, right? Because the thing is, who was the one that spoke out in the beginning? The Saudi king was the one that claimed that Hezbollah is occupying Lebanon and that they're a terrorist organization. Right. So it was not Hezbollah that started. So Hezbollah should be protected and defended by the Lebanese people, as they protect Lebanon, as they protect the sovereignty of Lebanon, and they protect the borders of Lebanon and the people of Lebanon.
Okay. Now, Brian, Hezbollah leader also referred to this ruinous war that the Saudis have been leading against Yemen. And he's saying again that the Saudis are performing the dictates of Washington in Yemen. And you know what the situation is in Yemen. The UN is calling it the worst humanitarian crisis ever. Children losing their lives to even preventable diseases and all that. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, the horror of what's going on in Lebanon cannot be overestimated. It is horrific, and it can't be. It needs to be opposed. There cannot be any kind of neutrality in this. For the United States now, this recent $650 million air-to-air missile deal. They claim that Saudis are only going to use this in defensive purposes. And there's no control over that, Saudi Arabia is not facing any exterior threat. It has suffered some drone attacks from out of Yemen, but it's because it's in response to Saudi aggression and the blockade. So there isn't any reason to give. Saudi Arabia does not need any defensive weapons, and they're not being used defensively. This is a cash cow. This is a lot of money, and it's the control of the region, and the control of the region not for the benefit of the people who live there, but for not even for the people of the United States or the people of the United Kingdom, but for the people who are at the very, very top, the billionaire class of this military-industrial complex.
Right. Yes, I would just, if I can just say that, on the anniversary of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, also Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has mentioned that Saudi Arabia has a role in the assassination, and they have assisted the Israelis and the Americans and so on, whoever was involved in all this criminal act. And this is why he actually chose this day to speak about this situation and to, send a strong message to the Saudi regime that, we will not sit silently and watch you work against the interest of the region and kill our generals and work as a traitor against us, I think he had the very, very, right time he used, and, this is going to change things, yes. Lebanon is going to suffer, but, this is going to bring about an understanding of what really is happening. And hopefully this will bring a strong change for Lebanon and for the whole region, that they should speak out against bullies.
Okay. And Brian, we have 1 minute left. If you could tell us about the role that the U.S. has been playing in this, and you also, because you mentioned also the U.S. has been behind this and the Saudis have been acting and taking orders.
Yeah, it's the United States is the instigator. Not so much our government, even our government, because our government is enthralled to this military-industrial complex. It's the arms manufacturers, and the continuing war, the continuing flow of weapons is benefiting a very, very small cadre of people and very powerful. And this has to be spoken against by Prime Minister Makati. He said recently, it's true that we disassociate from conflicts, but we don't disassociate ourselves from a position in solidarity with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. And that's absolute nonsense, because if you're in solidarity with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, you are involved in the conflict. And it has to be, Lebanon needs to, and the United States, the countries of the world, need to disassociate themselves from solidarity with Saudi Arabia, whether it's through rhetoric or whether it's through weapon sales or military cooperation. You can't be neutral in this. As Desmond Tutu, Archbishop from South Africa, who just died, said, if in a situation of injustice you are neutral, you've chosen the side of the oppressor.
Right.
So this needs to be spoken and acted against in totally unambiguous terms. We have to say no to Saudi aggression and the U.S. support of it.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this program. Thank you, my guests, political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell O'Malley and manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm in Ottawa. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: مقاربة الناس في أخلاقهم أمن من غوائلهم.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Nearness with people in their manners brings about safety from their evil."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So, dear friends, when discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, truly it is astounding when one understands that Imam Ali's persona is truly universal. It is applicable to every day and age. We find that various philosophers and historians or teachers or great scholars in history Well, they have remained in history and they have been forgotten in the pages of time. But when we see the divinely appointed imams of the household of the Holy Prophet, and when we see these divine messengers that have been sent to us by Allah, the Mighty, the Merciful, we see that their sayings and their personas are truly universal. And perhaps this is one of the secrets that Allah has in this realm of physical existence, is when you are in sync with the divine reality, then your persona and your sayings and who you are also becomes eternal. Now, sometimes we think about what is piety, taqwa. We think about how can we be content in our lives, what can we do in order to be happy, and along those lines, what can we do to be satisfied with our lives and what we have? Well, it is interesting, but Imam Ali alayhi salam, he speaks about something called contentment, something about being content with what we have, right? And so here Imam Ali says that a human being reaches the ultimate degree of piety, of taqwa, when they are content with what they have and they do not overreach themselves. And so taqwa, of course, has been defined in various ways. It can be said to be piety, which is one of the most common translations of the word taqwa. But it is also known as this awareness of Allah, this consciousness of Allah. And it is in reality this consciousness and this awareness of Allah which leads us towards the other definition of taqwa, which is piety. Of course, one who is more aware of the presence of Allah around them, the more pious they will be, meaning the more they will refrain from what is haram and prohibited, and the more they will try to do their wajibat, the things that have been made obligatory upon them. And so here, in an interesting definition of piety, Imam Ali says that the ultimate degree of piety is when one is content, when one is satisfied with what they have, meaning they are grateful for what they have, they appreciate what they have, and they don't have a greed to acquire more and more material wealth or material prosperity, gold and silver and gems and money and the like. Now, just as a quick caveat, we need to understand that just because we are told that we should not have the greed for this material wealth, not having the greed for it does not mean that we shouldn't work for it, right? By no means are the Ahlul Bayt saying that we should be poor and we should be paupers and we should be beggars. No, we should not have the greed and the love and the attachment and the infatuation with this materialistic physical wealth and materialism. But yes, if God has given us a position where we are able to make money and make wealth, then we should. We should make money, we should make wealth, but again, with another caveat, that we should spend it upon the path of Allah. We shouldn't spend all of our wealth upon ourselves, right? That which is needed should be spent on, and that's where contentment comes in. We should be content with what we have, and we should not overreach ourselves and become greedy for that which we don't have. And finally, if we have extra, we should most definitely give it on the path of Allah and for the sake of Allah. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.